pulling out teeth.
It's a very great honor to be here. My wife and I have a thing that we love to speak to people who have successfully raised children who we admire, because, you know, with all the work that we do in terms of other people's children, sometimes with your own children, you're most nervous and you want to make sure that you know what you're doing. And Mrs. Hertz is therefore one of our heroes in terms of the kinds of children that she raised that we are zocheh to be very close with, and that's why I responded within 3 minutes. If she would say jump, I would say how high, and it's a great honor to be here. Now, I want to ask you a question. I just want you to think in your mind for a moment, and if you have an answer, raise your hand. I can't imagine there's going to be a single person here that does not have an answer. I want to ask you if you could summarize the story of Hanukkah. In one sentence, if you could summarize the story of Hanukkah in one sentence, and we're going to start with you, we're not going to start with me. So someone's going to raise their hand, you're not going to be shy. Summarize the story of Hanukkah in one sentence. We got a hand. Fantastic. What was the nays? Several. Okay. Now, what you gave is the correct answer. That we were, as everyone knows, we were threatened by the Greeks. It was going to be the end of Yiddishkeit as we knew it, the end of the Beis HaMikdash as we knew it, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu saved us. The Gemara asks the question, my Hanukkah, and it tells an entirely different story. An entirely different story. Not really about the Greeks threatening our religion, not about how there wasn't going to be Emunah B'Hashem anymore, not about the Misyavnim, not about what was happening with the Jewish people. It tells an entirely different story. And it's also a story you all know. What story does it tell? About a little bottle of oil. A little jug of oil that they found in the Beis HaMikdash after the place was ransacked. I remember when my daughter came home from school a few years ago when she had first learned the Hanukkah story in school. We are Zocha, my wife and I, to have four sons. Our first four children are boys. And then we were Zocha to have our daughter. So we love her very, very much. And my sons sometimes ask, why do you love her more than us? And we say, because she loves us more than you love us. And she doesn't do anything. It's not that she can do no wrong, it's just that she does no wrong. So as I was saying, my daughter came home from school one day and she was telling us the Hanukkah story. And the story she learned was, and this was as a preschooler, as a very young child, they came into the Beis HaMikdash and they made a big mess. They messed everything up. Like when you invite a friend over and they make a huge mess and then they leave and now you're stuck cleaning it up. That's what happened. They made a huge mess. And you know why they taught it to her that way? Because how are you going to explain the concept of Tumah to a four-year-old? How do you explain the concept of Tumah to a 14-year-old? Tumah is not an easy concept to understand. What exactly are you going to say? They took the oil, and you know what it was? It was physically perfect. They really did nothing to it. They just touched it. They just, you know, opened the bottle. It's really difficult to explain. So they described it as they made a big mess. And this was the great miracle, that there was one bottle that they didn't make a mess out of on a spiritual level. I don't know if you remember, a few years ago, there was an event that happened in New York City that was called the Miracle on the Hudson. Have you heard of the Miracle on the Hudson? I believe they recently made a movie out of it. That's how great a story it was when you get Tom Hanks to play the lead role in a movie. That's a big deal. It's a big deal. And what happened was there was a pilot, and his name is, I don't even know what his real name is, but he is known as
Sully.
Okay, so Sully was flying a plane, and the plane was going down, and miraculously, really miraculously, he landed it on the Hudson River and everybody was safe. People who were sitting in the front of the plane didn't even get wet. In the back of the plane, they got wet. That's why first class pays. But in the back of the plane, they had to like roll up the pants a little bit. They got a little bit wet. But in the front, they didn't even get wet. They later discovered, had he been off by 1 foot, 1 foot, in one direction or the other, the whole thing would have fallen apart. People would have died. And he managed to land the plane perfectly on the water. Had there been any other pilot than Sully, probably the story would not have ended nearly as well. An amazing miracle. An amazing miracle. Now imagine for a moment that everyone goes out, you've seen the picture, right? They go out on the wings of the plane. Imagine for a moment that one flight attendant would have had the presence of mind as everyone's leaving the plane to grab the cart and fill it up with cold Cokes and Diet Cokes and bring it along the wing of the plane. And, you know, everyone's just had a stressful landing. You know, you think you have a bad flight, you know, imagine that. And gives, what would you like, regular Coke, Diet Coke? You sure you don't want a diet here? Okay, and gives everyone gets a cold can of Coke or Diet Coke. And, you know, they're enjoying a can of Coke or Diet Coke on the wing. And then a year later, they celebrate the miracle on the Hudson. And you know what they make a huge deal out of? The Coke. It was amazing. It was like an ice cold Coca-Cola. It was like a little bit of a warm day. It was amazing. It was just so great. That would be ridiculous. They're missing the point. That's not what the story was about. The story was about the plane. You could have all died and you landed and everyone was safe. What are you celebrating a Coke? The story of Hanukkah is equally troubling. You know what we actually celebrate? Our religion was saved. You know, everything could have been destroyed. Our place to greet HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to meet with Hashem, would have been gone. We wouldn't have even known what we believe. We wouldn't have even known what we're really serving. And you know what happened? There also happened to have been a bottle of oil that was unaffected. Ooh, let's celebrate the bottle of oil. Great miracle, great miracle. But that's not the point. Why do we put so much emphasis on that bottle of oil? So in order to answer that question, let's take a step back. You just davened, I saw. So a lot of you have sidurim on you. If you open up your sidur to Al Hanisim, special prayer that we say on Hanukkah. So what do we celebrate? We celebrate this great thing that happened, and we talk about it. If you look inside in the Siddur, we talk about it, and you'll translate for me, for those who have translations or those who know. You know what was great about this battle? And in the Al Hanisim, by the way, we're not talking about the oil, we're actually talking about the battle. Giborim biyad chalashim. What does that mean, giborim biyad chalashim? The strong in the hands of the weak. It was a David and Goliath story that it made no sense that these Jewish weaklings were going to be able to beat up on these mighty Greeks. It made no sense. That was miraculous. Okay. Rabim biyad ma'atim. Many in the hands of the few. If the five kings are fighting the four kings, it's a miracle if the four kings win. It's what we call the Electoral College. The many in the hands of the few. It's a great miracle. It doesn't really make sense. Worth celebrating. Tmeim biyad tahorim. Impure in the hands of the pure. Now, I like to think of myself as a pretty pure person. You know, try to live my life the right way, observe all the mitzvahs. Imagine I'm walking in a dark alley somewhere. Don't ask why I'm there. I'm there to do mitzvahs and ma'asim tovim, save neshamos or something. And I see this fellow who doesn't look particularly pure, but looks particularly large and strong. And he threatens me. And for some reason, I'm in a bad mood and I take him up on, you know. Would it be a miracle? Well, let's put it the other way. I'm saying it backwards. So let's imagine that as a pure person, I'm also super strong. And the impure person is a little weakling and he starts up with me. Does my level of purity really matter in the fight? Why should it matter at all? Why is that even a miracle? That to me, you know, we're talking about the miracle. Oh, strong people are supposed to beat up on weaklings. And look, the weaklings won. The many are supposed to beat up the few. And look, the few won. Well, Tmeim biyad tahorim? Okay. Tell me a little more about this tahor and I'll tell you if it was a miracle or not. Did he know karate? Like, did he have weapons? I don't know. Tell me a little more. Why is that inherently a miracle? And aside from that, what do we really mean by tamei? over here? Does it mean ritually impure? Does it mean, oh, these were people who were in a room with a dead body, and these were people who happened to have not gone to a funeral that day? Is that what it means? Now, you know what Tamei Biyah Torah means? The good guys beat the bad guys. That's what it means. Which makes it all the more troubling when you keep on going. Rishaim Biyad Tzadikin. What does that mean? The good guys beat the bad guys. Oh, but not only that, Zaydim Biyad Oske Sarasecha. The good guys beat the bad guys. So we have the many, the few. Okay. The strong, the weak. Okay. The good guys beat the bad guys, the good guys beat the bad guys, the good guys beat the bad guys. Why do I need that one three times? In three slightly different ways of saying the same thing. So I once thought that maybe what's really happening over here is that there were three different battles that were going on, and really three different things that we're celebrating in a few weeks when we celebrate Hanukkah. And it's especially important this year when the non-Jewish world sees the coincidence of the calendar that Hanukkah happens to fall out the same time of the year as non-Jewish holidays. So, you know, people assume that the way to properly respect all the holidays is you get the tree and you put a little menorah on top. You know, because it's the Jewish version of. And that's most unfortunate. Because it's not the Jewish version of. It's in fact a holiday that celebrates that we are fundamentally different from. I think it celebrates this in three ways. First of all, when we have to fight a battle against foreign influence, on the most basic level, the battle has to be fought when the influence is coming from the outside. When there's a culture of lahashkicham tarasecha, ulahavira mechukei ratzenecha, to make us forget about the Torah and forget about mitzvos, and to be distracted by everything else going on in the world. And historically, our enemies achieved that in one of two ways. Either they were extremely friendly to us and said, you're welcome in our culture. That was very rare in history. But we were so excited to be welcomed, we just bought in and jumped right in to the culture. Or, more commonly, they persecuted us. You're different. We don't like that you're different. And we don't want you to act differently. And therefore, we're going to put you down and we're going to destroy you. Those are the two ways that a foreign culture can affect us. And Chazal tell us, you know, when we talk about Temeim Biyad Tahorin, Temeim is another way of saying non-Jews who aren't behaving properly. We do not call Jews who are not behaving properly Temeim. Yeshayahu HaNavi made that mistake once. He said, "B'toch am Temeis v'asayim enochi yoshev," that I am amongst an am Temeis v'asayim, I'm amongst Temeim. And God punished him. You don't call the Jewish people Temeim. The Jewish people are not Temeim. If you think about some of the names we call each other sometimes, you know, Temeim almost seems benign. Like you wouldn't get in trouble for bullying if you call someone a Tamei. But yet God punishes Yeshayahu HaNavi. No, we don't call the Jewish people Temeim. And on the first level, we're celebrating that we overcame the influence from the outside. Temeim biyad tahorim. It's very enticing. Some elements of the culture are good, and we try to learn from it, but so many elements are bad, and we have to learn how to sort of shut them out. And you know, if this used to be hard, today it's even harder. Because it used to be that before you left your house, you had to you know, get ready. I'm about to face the big world out there, and I'm going to have to deal with it. So, like, you're on guard. But then as soon as you come out, you relax a little bit. Because now I'm in the Kedusha of my Jewish home, and there is nothing that can infiltrate these walls. I'm okay. So you have time to regroup and to re-energize. We've never had a time in history where 24/7 we're subject to all of the influences and messages and the whole advancement of society in the last 10 years has been through social media, where everyone can see everything instantly. And it's all available, always. And I'm never without this. I could respond to an email that I'll speak in Shevach in 3 minutes' notice. Because I have this. And we celebrate that we have the ability to overcome all of those foreign influences. That's one type of influence. But then there's a second battle. I probably should have asked what time I have until. What time do I have until? What's the... Great. The second battle. The second battle is when we fight influences from within our own ranks. The inroads have already been made. You know, people, particularly at your age, and this is not a criticism in any way, this is a fact, people at your age tend to value friends more than at any other age in your life. Probably overvalue the importance of the role of friends. And that's why you hear a lot about peer pressure when you're talking about kids in junior high school and high school. You don't hear that much about peer pressure before that or after that. Because when you're younger, you know, I mentioned before my daughter. I know that when I come home tonight, I think tonight, but certainly last night and the night before and every night that I come home, my daughter, as soon as I walk in the door, Abba! It was the greatest thing. There's going to come a day where I'm going to come home. Oh God, Abba, you're so annoying. And that's going to be a change. It's going to happen. I'm going to cry, but it's going to happen. It's going to happen. Because there comes a time where there's an emphasis on friends. It's just natural. It's naturally the way people develop. And what kinds of influence those friends are becomes very important, because it's not an influence from the outside. You know, there used to be a thing on ESPN, the sports network. I don't know, I taught in boys' high school 17 years. Everything was an ESPN muscle. So there used to be a thing on ESPN where, you know, when there was no sports going on, they televised something called the World Series of Poker. You know what the World Series of Poker is? It's what it sounds like. It's a bunch of poker players who are being glorified. Now, people who play poker for a living are degenerate gamblers. They are the kind of people you would not want to meet in a dark alley. They are the kind of people that you would look at them and be like, okay, I do not want that influence. But imagine it's not those people. You know, the poker games are happening with Chevra from the neighborhood or whatever. A lot of the things that could be coming from the outside, once they've already infiltrated, and it's our own friends, and it's, you know, people we know, and the people that we daven shul with, it becomes so much closer, becomes so much easier to fall prey. You know, Moshe Weinberger points out that when we talk about marriage at Shavuot Brachos, we talk about Reyim HaHuvim. What are Reyim? What does Reyim mean? Friends. Reyim has the word Ra in it. A chaver, a friend, jumble the words, charav, destroy. But kenelech chaver, we're supposed to have friends. Yes, of course we're supposed to, but we have to make sure that they're the right kinds of friends. And we have to make sure that the influence is going in the right direction. And that's the second battle that we fought. Because do you think when we say Rabin Biad Ma'atim, it means that for every Jew there were 10 Greeks? No, that's not what it means. It means that for every Jew who believed, there were 100 Jews who didn't believe. It was the influence from within that we had to overcome. And then came the final battle. And the final battle is not a battle over ideology at all. And by the way, that second one, that's Rishayim Biyad Tzadikim. You could have Jews who are Rishayim. But then comes Zaydim Biyad Oskei Sarasecha. Now, Zaydim does not at all refer to an influence from the outside. It's an influence that doesn't even involve any ideology. It doesn't even involve anything that's that enticing. You know, Ephraim Waxman gives a mashal. Just imagine, a guy is walking on a beach somewhere, and he stubs his toe. It's a totally empty beach, he's not doing anything wrong. He stubs his toe. And what did I stub my toe? Was it a seashell? No, it's not a shell. And he starts moving the sand away. And there's a giant treasure chest full of treasures, and he tries to lift it out of the ground. What a boon! He found this amazing, wow! So he can't lift it. He needs help. So where does he go for help? He quickly covers up the treasure chest. He has no one else will find it. Runs to the nearest town, and he sees a guy leaning against the wall like this. I don't want to ruin the sign. Leaning against the wall. And he says to the guy, there's a treasure. I'll split it with you. There must be millions, billions. I don't know what's in there. Come help me schlep it out. I'll split it with you. The guy says, look, I would love to. I would love to, but I'm very busy right now. I can't. What are you doing? You're not doing anything. You're just leaning against... You see this building behind me? It's 100 stories high. If I walk away from this building for a single second, the whole thing's going to come caving in. I'm holding up this building, all the people's lives, all everyone inside there, they're depending on me. So the guy's like, okay, this person is insane. He really thinks that by leaning against the building, he's holding up the building. He goes off by the pier, and he sees a guy standing by the pier just going like this, just blowing. He says, excuse me, treasure chest, billions of dollars, help me, split it, you know, the whole deal. And the guy says, I'm sorry, I'm very busy right now. Just blowing with all of his might. And he says, why? What are you busy with? What are you doing? You see the waves from the ocean and they're coming in? If I don't blow them back, the whole land is going to flood. It's going to be like Sandy times 10. It's going to be horrible. So I have to keep blowing the water back. Okay, the person's a mishugan, he's out of his mind. So he goes and he finds a third guy sitting on a park bench. Okay, this guy's mamish doing nothing. He's sitting on a park bench. And it happens to be raining outside. And he hears him muttering as he gets close, and the guy's muttering numbers. 5 billion times 3 times 10, blah, blah, blah. Muttering numbers. And he says, listen, sir, you don't seem very busy. Maybe you can help me out. Treasure chest, billions of dollars, split it, the whole, it goes through the whole spiel. And the fellow says, I'm sorry, I'm just very, very busy right now. 10 billion, 10 billion. What are you doing? He says, well, the raindrops. I'm counting the raindrops. Ephraim Waxman asks the following question. Who's the craziest of those three people? The guy holding up the building, the guy blowing the ocean back, or the guy counting the raindrops? Why is the guy counting the raindrops the craziest? If you were to ask the guy, well, you can't hold up a building either, and you can't. If you were to ask the guy who's holding up the building, why is it important that you hold up the building? Granted, he's insane for thinking that he's actually doing that. But why is it important? He could explain to you why it's important. He can explain. It's important to hold up the building because there are people inside. And if this building caves in, it would be a disaster. He could at least explain to you why that's an important thing to do. If you were to ask the guy who's blowing at the ocean, you're crazy for thinking that the ocean, that you're affecting the ocean in any way. But why is it important? He'd be able to explain to you, as misguided as he is, that if the ocean were to overflow and those waves were not to be stopped, it would be a disaster, a natural disaster. But if you ask the guy why he's counting the raindrops, even l'shitaso, even according to his own way of thinking, that he's able to count the raindrops, so what? Even within his own way of thinking, why does that matter? The final battle is not the battle against an ideology that comes from the outside, an ideology that comes from the inside. It's the battle of our generation. We don't really have major ideological battles. You know, I taught in high school for 17 years, and I rarely, if ever, encountered someone who had serious ideological issues. Usually it was just being caught up in narishkeit. You know, if you could explain to me why my 13-year-old thinks it's important that he could flip a water bottle and it will land like that, explain to me why that's important. Or why is it so important that we can all freeze at the same moment and someone can walk around with a camera? Why is it? Does it make sense? Is this an intelligent thing? I confess, I participated in one and I enjoyed. And Aaron Hertz had one in Cedar Market, and I enjoyed watching that also. But why is this an important thing? Why is this an important... the things that we get caught up in, it's not an ideology that's off base. We're not the guy who's holding up the building. We're not the guy who's blowing back the ocean. What we tend to get caught up in nowadays is just ridiculous. Things that we couldn't even explain. Imagine someone landed from outer space and tried to observe our culture and saw the way people act at a sporting event. It would be like, oh my gosh, like I could be getting the premise totally off because I don't, but you would imagine the Hunger Games, right? Where it matters, like if that ball goes into the hoop, someone's going to die if that ball doesn't go into the hoop because these people are crazy, they're screaming, and that better happen. It must be life or death. Try to explain that to somebody. But we know we have something that's actually valuable. And that's what we have to remind ourselves on Chanukah, and that's what we celebrate on Chanukah. We celebrate that we're unique, that we have something special. You know what they were trying to do when they, instead of ransacking the Beis HaMikdash the way my daughter told me when she was in preschool, what they actually did was sat there just unscrewing each bottle of oil and touching it. You know what they were trying to do? They were trying to say, do whatever you want in your Beis HaMikdash, just know that there's nothing special about it. That there's no such thing as Tahara, there's no such thing as Kedusha. There's nothing that makes you different, but we know that there is something that makes us different. We know that we do have something very special. And that it's not just meaningless activity after meaningless activity. That we're standing on the shoulders of centuries of giants who brought us to this point, to a sense of Kedusha. And that's why this year when we celebrate Chanukah, we're going to remember that Chanukah is not just our version of. It's not our version of anything. Chanukah represents that the Jewish people are special, that we have what to celebrate each Rosh Chodesh, we have what to celebrate each Yom Tov, and we should always recognize our uniqueness and what makes us special. Have a wonderful Chodesh, everybody.